This week on The Photographer's Perspective, I talk with photographer Rad Drew about creative photography with your iPhone, infrared black and white photography, and creative post-processing. I've been fortunate to work alongside some of the world's most inspiring photographers. I've watched how they've helped others at our conferences and transform the way they see through the lens. Welcome, I'm your host, Chris Smith, founder of Out of Chicago. This is F8, The Photographer's Perspective, the show where we have candid conversations and go in-depth with the pros to get to know them better. Join us each week as we discuss photography, get to know their personal perspectives, and introduce you to new places and experiences, helping you get the most out of your creative passion. All right, I'm here with Rad Drew. Welcome to the podcast, Rad.
Hi, Chris. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. I think you just got back from a workshop yesterday, right? What was that all about?
Well, I was out in the Palouse, and a lot of people say, what's a Palouse? Well, it's it's Eastern Washington State. It's the one of the largest wheat production areas in North America, and it's just beautiful rolling hills. This time of year, it's the color palette is green, yellow canola, chocolate fallow fields, and then just the incredible Palouse sky, which is always filled with these abundant clouds. It's just a beautiful place to photograph. I was out there with my friend and co-leader, John Barclay, and we were talking among ourselves. We decided that this is probably the place we say wow the most when we do photography of all the places we go.
Yeah. No, I've never been out there and I've always wanted to go. And I was looking at some of your images. You guys did a flight afterward. Did I read that wrong?
Yeah, no, you read it right, Chris. We don't do this with our, or we haven't done this with our groups, but at the end of our workshop, John and I went to a local airfield where they have a couple of Cessnas, and we each took a plane up with a pilot there, and they fly us over the region that we've been shooting on the ground all week. So we get an aerial perspective of everything from about 1,500 feet. And it's just a remarkable flight. You know, this little Cessnas are two passenger planes, basically. So, you know, I'm sitting there next to the pilot with shooting out the window of the door that I'm at. And the neat thing about it, it's about the same height that you're at when you're up on Steptoe Butte, which is the tallest land feature in the area. But the nice thing about being in the plane is that you can shoot almost straight down to these rolling hills. And if you go, as we did, around 6:30 in the evening in June, we had long shadows from the trees and hills. And you get these remarkable textures and patterns of plowed fields. And it's just really, really remarkable. Most of my pictures are out on my Facebook site if anybody's interested in seeing those. And, of course, John will have his posted as well on Facebook and Instagram. Really, really fun stuff.
Oh yeah. I bet you didn't want to come down from that flight. There's just got to be so much to see, right?
Oh, I could have stayed up a while longer for sure.
Oh man. So you and John Barclay are both going to be presenters, instructors at the Out of Longwood Flower and Garden Photography Conference. And we are super excited I've wanted to work with both of you for a really long time, and we finally made it happen, and we've just got an amazing lineup for that one. So I'm really excited. And that's just outside Philadelphia. It's pretty much sold out. Maybe we could fit one or two more people in. But yeah, that's going to be really good. Like you're not really known as the flower photographer. You know what I'm saying? Like when people think Rad Drew, they don't think the flower photographer, but I look through some of your stuff and you have some amazing flower photos, some close up and some, more the whole, you know, landscape with flowers. Like what kinds of things are you going to be helping people with in Longwood?
Well, at Longwood, I'm going to be focusing primarily on the use of the iPhone to take images or create images. And so what we'll be looking at, there are just so many different ways to photograph flowers. And we'll be looking at using a technique it's also often known as ICM or in-camera, intentional camera movement. I call them swipes, where you set your phone using a certain app and you intentionally move the phone to get a blur and almost an impressionistic looking image. So we'll be doing that. I love the new two lens iPhones for the 7 Plus up that allow us to capture images with a narrow depth of field. particularly the 10S, which allows you to not only capture the narrow depth of field, but adjust it after the fact. So you can take something down to as far as 1.4 for a very blurred background, or up to 16 for having everything in focus. It's really fun to do that with flowers, where you focus on one and let your colorful background of other flowers around it go soft. So we'll be playing with that. Just a lot of things. You know, when the selfie, you hear a lot about selfies, and it's one of the things I try and avoid, taking selfies of myself.
I saw a couple on your site, by the way.
Well, the selfie camera, though, there are actually some things you can do with the selfie camera that I had never thought of until recently. And so I'll be sharing some things about how to get some unique perspectives using the selfie camera. And then also, one of the things with the iPhones today, there are a lot of accessory lenses out there. Three in particular that I like. There's the Moment lenses, which are probably the best glass in the business. Right behind them are the Olaclip lenses, which are also very good. And then there's another lens kit by Zeitlis that I like, which is they call it the 6-in-1. And each of these has its good qualities. And we'll be looking at those examples of those different lenses, so people can choose the one that works best for the kind of shooting they do. That allows you to take long shots where you are getting up to four times closer to your subject, or also taking wide angle, fisheye, and macro photos, which can be really a lot of fun when you're photographing flowers and that longwood.
Man, I have so many questions now, but one of them is just like, when do you choose that I'm going to shoot with my iPhone and I'm going to shoot with, I know you shoot with a Fuji as well. When do you make that choice?
Well, you know, I often take the same scene with both cameras, but typically your iPhone is not going to let you go to get a long shot. You're not going to do bird photography at 100 yards or anything like that. Typically, that may come someday, but right now we're limited to, about a 60 millimeter reach. And so a lot of times it's governed by that. But for most things that are close, portraits, narrow depth of field scenes now, I can't distinguish often by just looking at the images, my iPhone images from my Fuji images, in terms of what they actually look like. Now, you can look at the metadata and find that Fuji image is going to be a little larger, which might allow you to make a bigger print. But in terms of the quality for most size printing, it's almost identical now. And with some of the new software that's come out from Topaz, we have a tool now called AI Gigapixel, which actually allows us to take a low resolution image, run it through AI Gigapixel, and increase that image's resolution so that it can be printed with integrity at a much larger size. It's really revolutionary technology. It's essentially imagining missing pixels. If there are pixels missing in a scene, it's been trained by looking at so many images that it knows what trees look like, what clouds look like, and it replaces those missing pixels. It often improves the image. So it's really state-of-the-art technology.
Yeah, that's crazy. And I know you do a lot of work with Topaz, and you teach a lot of their videos online and that. So we'll get back to some of that in a little bit. But I just have so many iPhone questions. And, this is bad for me to use this platform this way, but I like to ask a lot of my own personal questions. So in a couple of months, I need to get a new iPhone. Which one should I be getting?
Well,
or should it not be an iPhone? I'm asking the right guy here. If anyone knows,
I get that question a lot, and I have nothing against, Android phones. Those phones are great. I've been asked to review them by Verizon. I've looked at the Pixel. I've looked at, Galaxy, X9 or Galaxy X9, I think. The technology is great. The challenge that I have in using the Android phones is that I can't find as many high quality post-processing apps for the Android. Now they're catching up, and many of the really good apps, Snapseed for instance, are created to work on both iPhone and Android. But many of the apps that I've used for many years or that I really like aren't yet available for the Android. So that's my main reason in preferring the iPhone. As far as which one you get, I just want to preface this to say that, you know, we all know that it's not the camera that makes the
But I need help personally. I need a little bit of extra help, I know. So what's come on? What's the best one?
Well, it's the loose nut behind the camera. So you'd be right there, Chris. so as far as the technology, my favorite phone of all of them that I've had is the current iPhone XS. This phone is remarkable in many ways. And it even I moved from the 10 to the XS. And at the time, I was thinking, why do I need to upgrade? And I did it somewhat reluctantly. But once I did, the things that it has built in, there is now a feature called Smart HDR. And I'm not going to be able to explain it technically, but I can tell you that you can turn this on, and every image you take, the iPhone will decide, is the contrast in this image, does it require or would it benefit from an HDR type of creation? And so it will take multiple images and blend them for you. And the results are amazing. One consequence is that I don't use many other HDR apps today. I used to, but now with the XS and Smart HDR, I find that I don't have the need for that. I use the native camera. The other thing that's remarkable about the XS, we were talking a minute ago about narrow depth of field and being able to get those portraits or images of flowers or whatever, where you have a sharp subject and then a soft bouquet in the background, that soft blur. The XS allows you to do that just as the 7 Plus and up does. But with the XS, you also have the ability to, in post, after you've made the image, you can adjust the f-stop, or it's actually a simulated f-stop. There's really no actual f-stop.
It's all digital, isn't it? Yeah, the way it comes.
All digital, simulating what a real camera would do. So you can take it down to as open as 1.4, which gives you a tack sharp subject, whether it's a flower or a portrait, and then this beautiful blurred background. That's one of the things that I really enjoy about this phone. The other thing is that it's available with a half a terabyte of storage space, so you no longer have to worry about running out of space or trying to clear your phone for new images. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't manage our images well, but that's not going to be an issue anymore. And for me, starting to shoot video and things like that, doing HDR with Lightroom, which is another option, you do create some very large files. So having that additional storage space has been good for me.
So what is, man, this could go on forever if I ask this, but I'm going to do it anyway. Like, what's your workflow then? So let's say, well, there's so many questions there. So you're going to take a photo with your iPhone. If you're using your iPhone, it sounds like one of your favorites is Snapseed, but I'm kind of asking this question, like, are things staying in your iPhone photo roll, or are they going to Lightroom Mobile, or are they going to Google Drive? How do you manage those? And then when you're back home on your computer, have them there as well.
Yeah. Right now I simply don't use Lightroom on my desktop. I'm in the process of moving to that. I'm working with my friend John and Barclay to make that transition actually this month. I've been putting it off forever, but typically what I do with my iPhone images, I have them in the Apple cloud. So I do have access to them on all my devices. So I take the photo with the native camera, it goes into the camera roll, and then virtually every image that I shoot, I process first in Snapseed. Snapseed's kind of like Photoshop in the palm of your hand. It's the most diverse and, what's the word I'm looking for?
Powerful.
Thank you. Yes, it does. It lets you do both editing and also stylizing within that app. So I use that to sharpen and adjust those kinds of things. White balance, maybe. It has a tone curves tool within it if you're used to using that. So what I like to do is get my image looking as good as it can in its natural state. Then I often go that next step and stylize an image, giving it a vintage look or a painterly look, or adding textures and filters to give it tone or mood. And some of those features are available within Snapseed. So it's an app. Most apps either do one or the other. They let you edit the image or they let you stylize the image. Snapseed lets you do a little of both. once I have that image, you know, in Snapseed, then I might take it into other apps to add textures and do other things with it. So that's kind of one avenue.
Wait. So back up a second ago, you said that you're trying to get rid of using Lightroom on your computer. Do you mean you're not going to use Lightroom at all? Like you and John are going to edit all images on your phone?
No. You misunderstood. First of all, John.
That's why I had to stop you, because I knew I was not understanding it right.
First of all, John's an expert Lightroom user, and he does use his Lightroom on his desktop. So no, I'm the one who does not currently use Lightroom on my desktop, but I have become just enamored with Lightroom CC on the iPhone. So the difference there is that, I mean, Lightroom CC has now come out. If you are a subscriber to the Creative Cloud, you can download the Lightroom CC camera app, the full-blown app with all the bells and whistles on your iPhone. You can then use that Lightroom camera to record raw images. And of course, raw images are going to give us a little more data that allow us to recover detail in blown-out highlights and in shadow areas. So they're far preferable. It's what big camera DSLR users and mirrorless users have been using for years now. And we now have that ability to copy those or to create those images using the Lightroom camera. Now, there are other camera apps that allow us to create raw files, but there are very few really good raw editors that work on the phone. Lightroom not only lets you capture the image or record the raw image, it also lets you process that raw file. And for those who do raw processing, you know, a raw file doesn't always look that good right out of the camera. You have to actually take it in and process it, set a black point, a white point, and do those things with the image to bring out the really good values in the image. Lightroom now for the iPhone allows us to do that right on our phone. And it's nearly the same, identical to what we use on the desktop. So it's a very powerful piece of software. So recently, within the last few months, I've been going to Lightroom as my main camera more than ever, because I like to shoot that raw. You also have the ability within Lightroom, you can use the auto settings, which I often do. They're very good. And even though I use manual on my big camera, I'd never think of using the automatic mode there. I do use it in Lightroom on the phone because it's so good. But if you want, you can choose a professional mode that allows you to have control of all those, you know, shutter speed, ISO, all of those settings that you might be familiar with your big camera. It also allows you to take HDR in that raw context. So you can set Lightroom camera on your phone to take a HDR image by combining raw files. So these files, once they're combined, they're pretty big files. I've found that I don't necessarily need to do that for many things because I have the ability to edit raw. I'm getting really high quality out of the images that I'm recording. I don't need the HDR. It doesn't really add anything to the image in most cases. So with the Lightroom workflow, it's a little different in that I take the image with the Lightroom camera, I process it in the Lightroom raw editor, and then I save it to my camera roll as a JPEG. So now I've processed the raw file and I've put the JPEG in my camera roll. At that point, I open that file in Snapseed and I fine tune it there. So I might have little adjustments I want to make, maybe some white balance things or just some little things that Snapseed can do to finish off that image. And that's essentially my new workflow. The other option that we have, one can create the raw image in Lightroom and actually save the raw image to the camera roll in the iPhone. Then you need to open up another app to process the raw. I don't see the real point of this because the best raw processor is already Lightroom. So why would you take it out of there to process it somewhere else? For example, Snapseed will process raw files, but it's a wimpy processor compared to Lightroom. It doesn't have as many features. It's really doesn't have as many options for us. And many times the raw files coming out of Lightroom, if we save a raw file directly to the camera roll, that file is going to be large. And if it's over about 30 megabytes, it's going to crash Snapseed. So anyway, the main reason that one might not want to use Lightroom is if they don't want to subscribe to the Creative Cloud. And right now, as far as I understand, it takes a $9 a month, $9.99 a month commitment to have Photoshop, Lightroom on your desktop, and Lightroom CC on your iPhone. And some people don't want to do that. So for those who don't, there are other options for processing RAW, but they're just not going to be as good.
Yeah, that all makes sense. Now, the thing I always thought is I don't want to just shoot with my iPhone because I'm not going to be able to do things like long exposures and the panning, the swipes, as you call them. I'm not going to be able to do all that. But it sounds like obviously you are, and that's part of what you're going to be teaching people in the field when we go to Longwood. So are you using this Lightroom camera to do those sorts of things? Is that how you do that?
Well, actually, the Lightroom camera, there is a feature in the Lightroom camera that lets us do a long exposure. To be honest, I haven't explored it as much as I would like to in the future. But there are ways currently using the native camera, the iPhone's native camera, and another app called Slow Shutter that allow us to do exactly that. So the first way I'll describe that one can get a long exposure image, let's look at the native camera again. And we've all probably done this, and I forget which iOS they started putting this in there, but there's an option called live mode. And if you've ever taken a picture and when you look at it, it moves a little. I've done it a million times when I haven't intended to turn on live, but it's on. If we've done that, what you're seeing is a live mode. They remind me of like the Harry Potter newspapers in the movies where the newspaper pictures actually move. What they're doing.
Yeah, or Tom Brady when they're like, here's Tom Brady. And it's like, wait, that wasn't a still. He's actually moving a tiny bit. Yes, exactly.
So it takes a little video clip. And so and I thought, why would I care about this? When it first came out, I was just annoyed with this feature that was just sort of gimmicky. I didn't get it. What I've learned since is that, let's say you're standing by in a beautiful scene in the woods and you've got a crystal clear stream running down with rapids and everything, and you want that soft water and you want everything else to be sharp around it. Without a tripod, you can hold your iPhone. You can hold your iPhone, set it to live mode, and take that photograph. Once you've taken that photograph, if you go into the edit or go into the camera roll where that image and pull that image up, if you swipe up on the image, you'll find an option you'll find four different options to select from. You can select the live mode option, which is going to give you that little movement. There's one called bounce, which has the movement going back and forth endlessly. And then there's another one, I forget what it's called, but it rotates the image around. I've lost the name of it for a second. But the last one is called long exposure. And when you click on that long exposure, it's going to make anything in the image that's moving appear soft, like that water, the stream, and everything behind it tack sharp. So you can get a photograph of a waterfall, of moving stream or whatever with your iPhone that normally you would need to use a big camera on a tripod, probably with a neutral density filter so you don't blow everything out. But with this live mode, you can get some really, really wonderful images just with the native camera. So that's one way to get a long exposure shot.
Do you ever use a tripod with your phone? Like, do you ever say, hey, I'm going to go all out and I'm going to use my iPhone, but let's get the tripod and let's make this happen.
Absolutely. So the other way that one can get a long exposure shot is to put the camera on a tripod and use the app called Slow Shutter by Kojicam. Anyway, it doesn't matter. There are a bunch of them out there. People can email me if you want to know the exact name of it, because there are several Slow Shutter apps, and you want to get the right one or it won't work. With that Slow Shutter app,
we'll put the link in the show notes in
okay,
too.
Yeah, that'd be great. It's Kojitap. That's the company name, Kojitap.
Okay.
At any rate, Slow Shutter allows you to set a host of settings. for the fundamental shot, and then you can actually then choose between three different motion modes and also adjust the light sensitivity and the time that this exposure will last. And you can also adjust the ISO if you wish, but I usually leave it on auto because, well, frankly, the camera's smarter than I am and it does a great job in auto. So what happens is you put the camera on a tripod, you focus your, compose your image, and then you tap the shutter and it will record for sometimes as few as 2 seconds. And in doing that, it will give you that blurred part that's moving and everything else is tack sharp. So recently I was at the base of some of the large turbines, that we see across hillsides in different places.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I photographed the turbines while they're spinning. And what I ended up with was looked like a grove of lollipops because the blades all create.
They have lights. Yeah. Is that why? Or was it during the day?
It was during the day and the light was shining directly on the blades. So I've tried it without the light on directly on the blades and you can't get the recording. But in this way, we ended up with some really interesting, fun images of these monoliths out in the field.
Oh, that is so cool. So let's actually talk a little bit about non-iPhone photography a little bit. And before we started recording this, you said, they're all just tools, I'll use whatever it's going to take to get the best image. And one of the things that I really like is you do a lot of infrared photography. Tell us about that.
Well, I did infrared photography back in college, which is many, many years ago, and it was really hard to do and it was hit and miss. You never knew if you got anything or not. You had to load your film in a dark room, not even with a safe light. You had to be in total darkness. So it was, a real chore and a lot of fun still. So today we have the opportunity to have a camera sensor converted to receive infrared light in a way that gives us these incredible high contrast black and white images or color infrared as well. I don't shoot color, but I have had two cameras over the years that I've done infrared black and white. And the one I had was a Lumix point and shoot fixed lens camera that zoomed to 8x. So I couldn't change lenses on it, but it was wonderful. I got it through a Spencer camera. They are one of the three companies that I'm familiar with who do a good job on infrared conversions. Spencer camera, I purchased the camera from them and had it converted, and the whole thing was around $600. So it was a really economical option for me to get an entree into infrared photography. And so part of what I like about infrared is that it helps us or forces us really to look at our scenes that we're seeing in different ways, because they're going to look very different than a color photo. With infrared, most of the time your green in an image, trees, grass, whatever, will go white. A blue sky will turn black and white clouds will just be really beautifully puffy white. So you can get these really magical images from an infrared composition. More recently, I've fallen in love with Fuji cameras and I really enjoy using them. They're lightweight, being mirrorless, and the quality of the images is great. And I love the retro feel of the cameras. So I shoot primarily with an X-E2 for my color images, but I have an X-T1 that I had converted by Spencer's camera to shoot 830 nanometers in infrared, which there are two that are most common. One is 720 nanometers and the other is 830 nanometers. The 830 requires you to shoot a little slower, so it's a little harder to handhold. But it also gives you a higher contrast image. So it's really kind of a preference thing. And I my previous one was a 720. The one I have now in the Fuji is a 830. So those are things to consider. But at any rate,
I have an X-T1 sitting right over there. I should get it converted. Yeah. Uh-huh. What lenses do you use with that when you're doing infrared, and are there issues with that?
Yeah, there are. And that's one of the challenges. If you do have a camera sitting on the shelf that you're considering having converted, the first thing you want to do is talk to the company you're going to use, whether it's Spencer's or whoever, many of them have a table on their website that shows which cameras are most suitable for conversion to infrared. Not all are, many are, but not every one. There are some also that allow you to use more lenses with them. I understand from my friend Tony Sweet, who's also going to be at Longwood this year.
That's right, yep.
That Nikon has the widest variety of lenses that will work with a converted camera. So with my camera on the Fuji X-T1, I have a 10-24.
I have that one.
18-135.
I have that one.
And a 100-400.
I don't have that one.
the 18-35 and the 100-400 work seamlessly at every focal length. The 10-24, if I take it wider than 14 millimeters, I begin to get a white spot. At all the way at 10 millimeters, I have a huge white spot in the center of my image. So to use that, I have to take it up to about 14 millimeters or beyond in order to use that lens. My understanding, again, I've only done infrared with the two cameras I mentioned, the Lumix and the Fuji. Some cameras, if you know, for example, you choose a lens that's a really wide range, 18-600 or whatever, or a 24-300, something like that, that's going to give you a really wide range, you can often have that lens calibrated to work with your converted camera. That would be something, again, to talk with your company about before you do it, and to know which lenses are going to work for you or not.
F8, the Photographer's Perspective, is brought to you by Out of Chicago. Out of Chicago brings together passionate enthusiasts with world-class photographers all in one epic location where you learn and shoot side-by-side with the pros. Since 2014, we've organized hands-on photography conferences in Chicago, New York City, Moab, and more. We are all photographers ourselves, so we understand what it takes to be inspired, get to the right place at the right time, and live our best creative life. So I'm going to play devil's advocate. Like, you make amazing infrared images in black and white with the setup that you're talking about. But on the other hand, can't I kind of do the same thing just in editing? Can't I like adjust like the what like each color when I'm doing my you know, each color balance or whatever they call it when you're doing the black and white conversion to basically get the same look or not?
Well, in a word, no. I mean, you can do a lot of things in editing that will give you a really remarkable black and white image, but it's not going to turn your green white and your blue black and give you that contrast that you get with infrared, in my opinion anyway. If someone's doing it, I'm not seeing it. I know there are some apps out there for the iPhone that say they do infrared, and they do a really nice job of high contrast black and white, but it's really not infrared. There's also some filters that you can get in different applications and plugins and things that will say they're an infrared filter. But I've not seen anything that yields the same result as an actual converted infrared camera.
So if I had an image that was like green leaves on a like kind of a mossy, or maybe that's not the best example, but like a similar color dark rock or whatever, like if I do that in processing, it's hard to get the contrast between those two. But if it were infrared, the true green leaves are going to give back and reflect that infrared where the rock will not. Am I right?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of contrast difference that you just can't get through the emulation.
Exactly. So just out in the Palouse recently, imagine a field where you have green wheat, a fallow chocolate field that's just earth, and then you have a canola, and above that you've got a blue sky with clouds in it. That image is going to, when you take that, all that wheat's going to turn white. That chocolate is going to be a really rich, dark color. Then you're going to have this dark sky with these white clouds. It just creates a fantastic image with the kind of contrast that you get from an infrared image.
And the proof's in the images. Your infrared images and Tony Sweet's images, they're just phenomenal. And yes, I've got to figure out a way to start doing this. So yeah, fine. I'll find the money.
Well, it's fun. It's just one more thing. And you know, part of what I enjoy about photography is that there's so many avenues that we can go down that provide opportunities for exploring our creativity and that sort of thing. So
Yeah. So we said about like Topaz and that you do a lot of their videos online, and tell people like what it is that you love about, well, obviously you're doing a lot of creativity in the field with your shooting, but there's also creativity when you get back home and, or wherever you happen to be in editing. Tell us about how you use Topaz to help your creativity.
Okay, sure. Yeah. I mean, most, a big part of the process today is done after you cap, you know, record the image on your sensor. And the thing I like about Topaz software, I'll have to reveal, I'm going to make a confession here. I use Photoshop, but I am not a Photoshop wizard. I know enough to get myself in trouble. I know it's a wonderfully powerful tool. I know many people who use it to great advantage, and I have not pursued that to get really proficient with it. No, and I'm not a Lightroom user at this time, although I mentioned I'm about to, with John's help, about to move in that direction. One of the things that I really appreciate about Topaz is how intuitive it is to allow you to do many of those things, and how powerful the different tools are. One of the areas that they have really excelled in the past year or so is artificial intelligence. And they have a whole suite of about 8 different apps now that are driven by artificial intelligence. And essentially what this means is they're training the software to recognize and emulate certain things that are missing in an image. They will have an image, a piece of software, examine millions of images to learn what certain things look like, what certain textures do, all of that. And the software that they've produced is really remarkable. Perfect example is a product called AI Clear. It's been replaced recently by a standalone app called Denoise AI, and it's a tool for removing noise from images, and it is truly remarkable. It allows you to, whether in some images that don't even appear to have noise in them, will show improvement with the running of this software. So that's what I love about it. They also produce some tools that allow us to create painterly images. There's a tool called Impressions, which lets you use different brush strokes and light positions and canvases and all these different things to create images that emulate paintings, the look of paintings. There are also textures available there that allow you to apply those. The thing, though, that I like most about Topaz is that many of these things exist where you know, there are a lot of apps out there today. You click a button and apply a texture or whatever, and you're done. And it looks like everybody else's image because everybody's doing the same thing. With Topaz, it allows you, each of these looks, you have the ability to go into them and customize them to meet, you know, to meet your vision. So your stuff looks unique. It's not looking like everybody else's because you've made decisions along the way to create this kind of light or this kind of brush stroke or emphasize the color in a certain way. And the Topaz tools allow us to do that really easily.
These tools are all on a PC or Mac, right? They're not.
Yes,
what you're talking about is not on a phone, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, Chris, because a lot of people get confused. They think Topaz can run on mobile phones, and it does not. Topaz is desktop software. It does work on Macs and PCs. It does. One of the things you'll want to do is look at the specifications page out on the website, because some of these apps, particularly these AI apps, do require some computing power that you may not have if you have an older machine or a machine with an older video card. So that is one of the important things to look at. But you know, once you have the specs, these apps run remarkably well.
And are you using them only for images taken like with your Fuji, or will you go into that Photos app and get your images taken on your phone and bring those into Topaz as well?
I do. Yeah. So one of the reasons that some of these AI apps are really valuable for mobile photographers, you know, when you take a mobile image, you're talking about maybe a 12 megapixel image, whereas, you know, your big camera is going to be 24 or more. So you're not able to print things as large with integrity. Well, with AI gigapixel, I often take my iPhone images that are, you know, 12 megapixels into AI gigapixel, and I can enlarge them literally to the size of a billboard with integrity in some cases. So what's happening is, as I said before, the software is imagining what's missing. If you blow that image up, you'll see holes where there are no pixels. The software imagines what should be there and creates it, and you end up with a very high res image that's often an improvement over the original image. So I print my work very large for exhibit and sale, and so that tool is a big help. The other thing that I'll often do is I'll take images into the Topaz products and use AI Clear or AI Denoise AR, the new upgraded version of that. If I have noise in my image, and it really does a remarkable job of helping with that.
Now, a lot of your images, you do some of these things, like you're saying, with the textures and that, and they're really, really cool looking. But I think there would be some photographers out there that say, hey, this is no longer photography, what you're doing. Like, it's obvious that was not just taken with a camera and straight out. What do you say to those photographers?
Well, I understand where they're coming from, but I don't have a problem. To me, you know, I don't want to say I call myself an artist, but I'm a creator. And if I have tools at my disposal that let me create something that it lets me explore ideas or try something new, I don't have a problem with doing that. And if I use a photo as the basis of my creative efforts, then I'm okay with that. I don't have a problem with it. I guess there's a line where if you're deceiving someone by misleading people that it's something that it's not, that would be maybe a line that I wouldn't want to cross. But to me, it's all about having fun and about playing and creating. And I say use the tools you have and brainstorm the kinds of things that you think look good. And your creative voice, you know, each of us has a creative voice, and it's just as important as the next person's, and it's unique because it's yours. So
everyone has their own way of doing it. Absolutely. Yeah. So do you have a line that you draw? Do you mind putting birds into the sky? Do you mind replacing a sky with a completely different sky? Are you okay with all of that? Are you,
you know,
or is there a place where you say that that's gone too far?
I'm personally okay with all of that. And, you know, we joke a lot. I don't put birds in a lot of my images, but there's a great app called Distressed FX that many iPhone photographers use. And one of the features is that you can add birds. And I don't do that very often, but a lot of times I'm asked, are those birds real? And I just ask them, do you think they're real? To me, you're creating a work of art. You're going for a look, a mood, a tone. And if having a couple of birds over a barn gives it a nostalgic feel that you didn't have before, why not? I think that's perfectly fine.
Yeah. So again, I'll play the devil's advocate, because sometimes I struggle with that. And I don't think I have added things to my images in the past. And I feel that everyone's got to have their own line that they draw. And then everyone realizes, well, that's what they do. But I myself sometimes feel like I want to be able to talk about one of my images and be able to say, yeah, I was there. And when those birds flew over the barn, it was so, and I grabbed it and it was awesome. And I worry sometimes to myself that, like, as soon as I add a flock of birds to one of my pictures, people start looking at all of my other pictures going, well, wait a minute, was that tree really there? Yeah, and was that really there? And I don't know. I struggle with that sometimes. Like, I want to play, like, but I feel like maybe that should be just a different folder in my gallery or something, so that people can be like, okay, that's where he messed with it. And here, no, these are, he was there. He actually witness that. I don't know.
Well, maybe you make a distinction between a photograph and digital art. I, you know, a lot of if you ever enter photography competitions, you'll often see categories like that where they will permit those kinds of things. I guess one thing that I see people doing that I'm less okay with, I see people, a lot of people taking clip art from sources that where they didn't create it, and incorporating that into their images in big ways. I mean, yeah, are birds clip art? Essentially, they are. That's a small feature to add to an image. But I've seen people build their whole image with clip art. And I guess that's another form of art. It's combining things. But I want to know that. I want to know that that artist found those images elsewhere and didn't create them themselves, maybe.
Well, there you go. That's what I was asking. Where does Rad Drew draw the line? Like, what you see in his images, except for maybe a couple dots of a bird, he took that photo. He was there. He saw that. It may be combined in a different way, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. If I do collages or if I do any of that kind of work, absolutely. It's my work. I mean, with the exception of, like I mentioned, the fun of adding birds through an app. But no, I photo, if I replace a sky in a bald sky, it's a sky that I photographed somewhere and it's my own image. So that's what I like to do. I mean, partly for me, it's just easier. I don't have to go out and hunt for some sky photos. I have a folder of my own skies, you know?
Right, right. Now, we had Jackie Kramer. She'll be with us at Longwood as well. And I really like what she does. She does a lot of texture work. But what I thought, the little twist that she put on it that I thought was really fun, is that she photographs her own textures, which is like, okay, that's good. So she's using her own textures. But not only that, but she does it like from the same garden. So every time she photographs a flower, she then starts looking for textures. And she says, well, I feel that they have the same DNA and they should go together in the image. I thought that was a really cool idea.
I like that. Yeah, I think that's great. And that said, Chris, I have no problem using flypaper textures, or Kathleen Clemens is a remarkable flower photographer from Maine. And Kathleen produces a line of textures that she created, and I use them all the time. I think they're wonderful. I will modify their opacity and other things to use it to blend with the image that I'm using it with, but I don't have a problem doing that. That I do, and I make my own too.
Good, good. I love it. Yeah. And actually, we've worked with Kathleen when we did the Out of Acadia conference. She came and she took people to all the gardens there. It was lots of fun.
Yeah, she's great.
So I don't know, anything else you want to throw out there? I mean, let's start with where people can find you. And then if there's one other thing you want to leave people with, we'll go with that. But what's your website? If people are interested in Topaz products, I think you've got a code that people can use. Throw all that stuff at us.
Okay, sure. Well, Topaz, I've been an affiliate rep with them for a little over 3 years now, which means I have a discount code that I can share with people. My code is RAD15. And when you use that code to purchase any Topaz product, you'll get a 15% discount and I earn a commission. So it's kind of a win-win. You can watch for webinars that are offered there too through Topaz. And typically if you sign up for a webinar and watch the webinar, you'll get a discount code for 20% off for a week after the webinar runs. So it's another great way to accumulate your Topaz collection. My website is raddrewphotography.com. Pretty easy to remember. I also have a YouTube channel where I post videos of how I have a tagline that I trademarked called How I Did It, because I always had people say, how'd you do that? So How I Did It, I have a series of videos that are out on YouTube, mostly on iPhone things, how to use Snapseed, how to blend images, how to a host of things. So those are there. They're free. You can tap into those. On the Topaz website, you can search for me as a presenter, webinar presenter, and you'll find many of my Topaz recordings, webinar recordings are there to view as well for free. A big part of my business is trips. I do a lot of tours around the world, and I just got back, as we mentioned, from the Palouse, and before that I was in Tuscany with a small group. So that's one of the ways that I enjoy sharing what I know. These many times are more tours than workshops, but where we actually work in the field on capturing images. And usually we will have at least one day or more in a classroom setting where we talk about more of the processing angle on things. So I have a number of trips. I go to Cuba 3 times a year, have for about 5 years. I've got wonderful trips coming up there. And we're still able to go in spite of all the noise we've heard recently about limitations and restrictions. I travel down there under a special designation by the U.S. government called Aid to Cuban People, and we are permitted to travel that way. And we photograph Cuba, Havana, Trinidad, ballet dancers from the National Ballet. It's just a wonderful trip. So, I encourage you to take a look at my website, see if there's anything out there. Maybe you want to join me for a trip in the next coming year. And I can't think of anything else, Chris.
No, I mean, if you just search Rad, R-A-D, Drew, D-R-E-W, it all comes up. So the Topaz, the workshops, the everything. So I encourage people to do that and learn everything they can about you. And it just, me researching for this podcast, you know, it gets me excited that we're going to be hanging out in Longwood together and to try all these different things. I mean, that's the best part about what I do is that I get to hang out with the world's best photographers and like earlier, ask them all my personal questions. And yeah, it's great for me. And we're going to have a great time at Longwood too. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, I will add, I do a monthly newsletter. I'm trying to get it out once a month. If people would like to sign up for that, they can do that. You can find a sign up thing on my website. And I typically publish links to videos I've done, articles I've written, resources that are useful. And then I also describe some of the trips that I have coming up and things like that. And I encourage anyone to contact me through email or text or however is easy, Facebook. I love getting questions about photography, and if I have an answer, I'm willing to share it. And if not, I'll help you find the answer with someone. I've got a lot of people out there who are great mentors to me, and my network is really strong. So I invite anyone to reach out that way.
Yeah, I mean, with what we do, with all the numbers of instructors that we work with every year, and attendees coming in, I always have people saying like, "Oh, have you ever considered having this person? Have you ever?" Well, I think you know, maybe the top person that people keep saying is, "You got to get Rad Drew to come to one of your things. Like,
really?
He's awesome." Yes, absolutely. I've had so many people say they've gone and done your things, and they're like, "He was great. I'm going to keep doing everything he does." And not only that, but I hope that you have him at some of these out of Chicago events. So.
Well, thanks for sharing that. That's great to hear.
Yeah, no, it really, and I hear it about a few people, and you're one of them right at the top. So, and I keep hearing it over and over again. So really excited to work with you in Longwood Gardens. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it too, Chris. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for all this. And yeah, we'll be shooting together, and maybe by then I'll have my new iPhone. We'll see.
Okay. I hope so.
All right. Thanks, Rad. Talk all right, soon.
Chris, take care.
All right. Bye-bye. F8, The Photographer's Perspective is hosted by me, Chris Smith, and produced by Out of Chicago. A special thanks to all photographers that share their inside knowledge to make this possible. We release a new episode each week, so be sure to subscribe to the show wherever podcasts are found. To learn more about Out of Chicago and upcoming events, go to outofchicago.com. Subscribe to our mailing list to stay connected and be the first to know of our next new location where you can shoot side by side with the pros.